Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisor of the Year.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch where each week, well, normally each week, Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property investing. But over the last week, had a bit of a challenge.
Hey, Bryce.
Hello, mate.
As IT people, we make really good property investors.
Hey, Ben, there's a rumour, has it, that Ivis had us down for a bit over a week.
We've let her go. Everyone, really sorry. Yeah. The stig is no longer
gone. Now the stig's gone. So, no. In all seriousness, Ben, over to Ivis. Yeah. What happened?
Yeah, what happened, Ivis?
Oh,
see that?
Yeah, she just came. So, folks, we have been inundated with people wanting to listen to the podcast, which caused our little server to...
our two Bob server.
Fatigue. So we've put...
Twice. Well, actually, three times there for a while.
So a shout out to our mate Greg Merrilies, Studio
happened.
One. He's helped us get onto a WP engine.
We lost a little mouse that goes around that sort of turns the wheel that runs the power for the server.
Well, I was been on a lunch break. So there we go.
So sorry.
So, we've been down. Rumour has it we've got it fixed forever, Ivis. Is that right?
Oh, forever.
Forever?
That's all right.
So
otherwise,
now,
she'll get another written warning.
So we should actually, for some people, what actually happened is when we brought it back over to the new server, Ben, it flew over to iTunes, and then all of a sudden, everyone thought they had 121 new episodes. So a little word of warning for those folks. If your settings suggest that it's going to keep downloading new episodes, every single one of our back catalogue is going to come up as a new episode. So be wary. Go into your settings so it doesn't burn your data.
Sorry.
But we got someone on Instagram, Ben,
wrote
in about that. He goes, man, you take your kids to Luna Park, you get to the door and say, turn around, we're not going in. That's how I feel seeing 79 new podcasts before he realised they were old. So that's encouraging.
Yeah. So only two new ones that we had a little bit of trouble getting up, but that's all right.
So today's episode, we're recording on Thursday morning and it should be available at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I was giving us an emphatic yes.
Yes. So what episode are we at? 122.
Did you know that? Or
just I just saw it on a piece of paper.
Yeah, 122.
We're getting professional now. You write things down.
Yep, I do, mate. Keeps it going. So, a couple of things. Realestate.com.au, season two, Ben.
I know.
We're filming tomorrow, so that's pretty exciting.
Yep,
so that's
some new vids.
Very well. So those of you who haven't checked it out, go to our social media. And, of course, the Money Magazine, there's a real estate guide, which it's got a rather handsome fella on the front cover.
Who is that? Ross Greenwood.
I wasn't talking about you, mate. You're in the bottom right corner there. But I was talking about you.
You got a face on it?
No,
oh.
I'm in the guide as much as you are. I think.
Effie, what are you doing?
I think
you don't sell magazines with my mug on it. I'll tell you right now.
I think with per hour per capita of time written in the magazine, I was a little bit in front of you. And you still get the cover.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
So I've been hopefully some good content. Check it out.
Yeah, it's good.
Most importantly, that's what we're good at.
And content. Of course, end of financial year, Ben.
Yes.
So almost Happy New Year time.
I know.
But the point of saying that is we went to dinner with our accountant last night and we said to him it's time to come back on to the couch because we've got some tax questions. So in the next, next couple of weeks.
A bit like location school. When's that coming?
It's coming.
Oh, exciting.
But Ivis, I think we'll get Frank back on. So it's a last shout out for any of our listeners, Ben, who have a tax-related question that you and I can't answer because it's tax-related.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get Frank on and he will answer that. So
beautiful.
Send that over to us. So cool, mate. Q&A day.
Q&A.
How good is that?
Very good, very good.
Mindset minute.
Yes, hit me.
The follow through determines the effectiveness of the hit. Think golf.
Yep.
If you don't do a good follow through, it will impact on the hit. If you basketball, straight up, follow through of the hand.
Yep, the gooseneck.
Gooseneck.
As they call it.
Golf. What about football? I watched Fremantle get pumped on the weekend.
Just.
It's just as bad as
just
being pumped.
Just snatched. They just basically clawed defeat from victory, didn't they? They're
correct?
Just beautiful. They just do a lot.
Zach Tui, who came from Carlton, he had the most, he was part of the comeback. And the kicks that he did in the final quarter, it was textbook. The follow through that he had on his kicks was just, if I wasn't a Fremantle supporter, I could have admired it. That's how
not
good
bad
was.
For an Irishman, too.
So the effectiveness of his kick was determined by his follow through bet. Mm. So the point in saying that is, from the perspective of investing, it's okay to get motivated. It's okay to, you know, get all this information. It's okay to establish
the
knowledge. But what do you say is our sign off?
Knowledge is empowering only if you act
follow
on it.
Through.
Follow through. I have to change
only
it.
Only if you follow through, Ben.
On the sign off, I'll try that.
So there we go, folks. My mindset minute theme today is the follow through determines the effectiveness of the hit. So therefore, folks, if you're going to learn how to invest in property, it's important that you act on that. So, Ben, that leads me into a bit of a segue.
Oh,
beautiful
segue. I love your segues.
You like that?
I'm going to take a seat. This is great.
Yep. Well, you should, because this is a long one. So someone's written into us. Said, hi, Ben.
And?
Don't I exist, Ibis? You? It says, hi, Ben.
Right.
So that's why you're the superstar on the cover,
right?
Property Investment Advisor of the Year. So I would just like to let you know, let you and Bryce know. So he's reading to you.
There you go. He's written it to me.
That your podcast is gold. Keep up the awesome work. You're doing a great service to the country for those that know about you. I just want to pass on a hopefully positive story with an almost negative undertone. My wife and I are in our mid-30s and have a steady income of $140,000 per year. We have our own PPR and have lived here for 8 years. We have two girls aged 12 and 7, both in public schools. My wife is an accountant by trade, but due to kids, doesn't work in this environment anymore. However, has the best money smarts I've ever seen.
Good on you.
Ever seen.
I remember this one now.
She's been almost replicating your money smarts for the last 12 years without even knowing about your setup. We have a full budget for everything, and that's in capital letters. And she tracks every purchase through our personal account software. We recheck every 3 to 6 months and track if we are ahead or behind. In brackets, we are always ahead. A few months ago, I spoke with a colleague at work who has 3 properties at the moment. I asked, how did you do it? And how did you get started? Here's where the scary stuff starts. He advised me of a guy by the name of Beep Beep, who runs a company called Beep Beep. I was told he does it all. Finds you a house, helps you set up the finance and the legals. We had this person sit with us and advise us of our position. So he showed us the graphs, showed us where we will go now with no properties and where we will be with properties. He showed us how it all works. Sounded great. So, in brackets, not hearing your podcast yet, we had the perfect property, a terrace house in X suburb, in brackets, off the plan. And there was quite a few exclamation marks. We needed to move on quick. Only 5 left. So we did it.
Ooh.
Scarcity.
Yep.
It worked.
Created.
Started the contract, started the finances. Here is where it starts getting better. Jeez, I'm reading like you. Fortunately, the bank would not lend due to the builder wanting progress payments. But due to the terrace house, in brackets, common walls, the bank wanted off the plan payment. During this time, 4 to 6 weeks, I was introduced to your podcast by another friend at work. He is more than a friend now.
Mate, we're
friend makers. I started binge listening to your podcast. Didn't I feel sheepish after only listening to 5 episodes that this was wrong? Anyway, we're able to get it out with the finance clause and it did not cost us a cent. However, this person was starting to push hard now. Had another best ever property for us. At this stage, I told him, no, we wanted to go pre-established.
Existing.
Well, he got the SH1Ts, and he didn't actually say it like that. Told us we were doing it wrong, and we won't have depreciation. We are paying more for stamp duty, and it goes on and on. In the end, he got very nasty, so we dropped him hard. Now, we started looking at our local area and found after about a month, a nice 3-bedroom house, less than 500 metres from the town centre. We've exchanged and the place already came with a tenant that wants to stay bonus. In short, I want to thank you guys for your wisdom. Since listening to you guys, I've started listening to Jane Slack Smith, read your book and Rich Dad Poor Dad, and watched a doco on Warren Buffett. I will not stop learning now. This email is more as you are the chair of Pippa. Now it's revealed by you. Sort of went to you rather than me.
Right.
I knew that. I was just building it up at the beginning.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make you aware of this person and hopefully put him on a watch list of some sorts. I will definitely not be passing on his details, but he will instead be sending them down to you guys. Regards, Joe and Sian.
Well, there you go. That's a lovely story. Obviously, these are our opinions, aren't they, in terms of what we've seen in our 20-plus years each of doing this. And for Sian, hey, Sian, guess what? You're a one percenter. You are one of the very, very few people in Australia in the one percenter categories who are elite money managers. So round of applause. Yeah. My hands are going around. Round of applause to you. That is brilliant, and obviously that is going to set up the foundations.
I didn't know when you did the round thing, that was actually...
That's the round of applause, don't you? Yeah, so you spin it around like that, and that's round of applause. I mean, that's it. When there's only one of you, you can only do round of applause. Anyway, congratulations, and it looks like you are now...
A winner.
Back on track, ready to rock and roll. Now, we're going to talk about the market, Bryce, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah, I want to talk about the market.
This is where I'll kick back, mate, because I've had a bit of airtime.
Okay, transition. I'd like to refer to this market right at the moment as a transitioning market. So we called it earlier that we're getting close to the peak, and we heard Damien, fantastic, last week, which actually was this week, because once we got the podcast out, we recorded it last week.
And he date stamped it, so it actually shows it was even longer ago.
So the reality is, that Damien's, auctioning every weekend and he's starting to see it. So it does appear. Now, it's not totally a buyer's market yet. Let's not call it too early. But what we are definitely seeing now is that the buyers feel a little bit more empowered to play the game a little bit more. So now why I call this a transitioning market is because... the expectation of the vendor is still very high. They've seen the house down the road sell, 2 months ago or 3 months ago for a price that they may not get at the moment. So this is this tug of war that's going on. We're seeing more buyers at auctions basically being more coy and keeping their hands in their pocket and not starting the auction. So this FOMO effect is the sentiment is shifting, so we're transitioning. Now, that doesn't mean all of a sudden we're going to see, again, vendors being dropping their pants, but this is the classic case. And the further support of that, Bryce, for the Sydney market, at least at the moment, because this is the market we're definitely calling, is that the stock, and I've said this before if you've listened in detail to our podcast, we know when it transitions because usually there is more stock coming on the market because people are sort of saying, oh, they always want to try and get the timing right. Well, usually they'll miss it and again, they'll miss it. So in the last 12 months, stock in Sydney has gone up 6.3%. Okay, now if you think about right across New South Wales, stock changes are actually down by 3%. So it does show you that some of the rural regional areas are still doing okay, but Sydney has now seen stock increase and it's starting to, now this is May data too. And we, the indications that we're also looking at is the clearance rates. So we're starting to see clearance rates in the 70s and some 60s. So that is a good indication to say we're coming back to more of a balanced market, not so much a buyer's market. So our indication of what we would consider a buyer's market is low 60s clearance rates because there will still be really nice properties that have owner-occupier appeal, which will have still a lot of competition on them. But those properties where people are thinking they're getting an outrageous price for are now going to soften off a little bit. So I think the bank levers, the APRA, all of those things are having an effect. It's now gone into the media. It's now gone into the psyche of the buyer. And now we're transitioning.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's actually a time to be really excited. You're going to have to work out if you're a fair weather investor or you're a long-term investor, because these are the conditions that you actually want to embrace. And I remember I was talking to the team that, I said to them, these are the conditions that we've got to let our clients know that what we've been wishing for the last 6 months, where we can go and buy A-grade properties in A-grade locations where the competition will be reduced. And I remember going through the GFC, Ben, I was talking to investors, it was more of a counselling service, but as I said, the really great properties never had multiple signs and never for sale. And if you think about, even the GFC, that gave back a bit.
Yeah.
Didn't give more than 10%, but it gave back a bit.
Absolutely it did.
But if we're playing, like we've talked to now, Tom Panos, Jan Summers, Craig Stevens. These people have been investing for 30 years. So they all they did was, you know, if they had a look at the performance of their portfolio, there'd be a bit of up and down, a bit of up and down, but the overall trend is up.
Yeah.
So the important thing is the transition market you talk about is if people have still got buffers in place, their cash flows allow, they buy the right assets, now's a really great time to embrace. Mm. But the herd mentality's going to be removed.
Shh, don't tell everyone this, Bryce, because I mean, I'm
just don't. Mate, despite saying it, you know, we'll get there. Even our own clients will be sort of saying,
yeah, they'll go, oh,
still
no,
it's too, I don't want to buy the top of the market.
Yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, that's what supply and demand indicators, what we're about, and we will obviously find those markets that are still showing good activity, but we want to basically buy at the right time in the cycle. So, yeah, there you go. So it's an interesting time, so I thought it would be good. We haven't spoken about, obviously, we had Damien talking about what he's seeing in Sydney, but we haven't had a market update for a little while, so I thought we'd just get into, you know, sort of seeing what we see out there in the marketplace.
Terrific. Love it. Hey, we've got some Q&As for today, Ben.
We do.
I've got one for you. Hi, Ben and Bryce. I've been a long-time listener since episode one, and this is from Alan. And I've learned so much throughout the podcast journey. I'm trying to get a better money management system and have just a few questions.
Mm-hmm.
I currently have one personal loan of $22,000 and two credit cards, both roughly $5,000 each. In your previous podcast, you suggest paying off whichever debt charges the most interest first. Well, the personal loan charges more than the credit cards in the long run, as has more to pay off, although the credit cards are of smaller amount, but it's still higher. Which would you recommend paying off first? Thank you for your advice and look forward to winning a signed copy of your book.
So,
Alan,
it's an interesting question. My view on this is, I mean, without knowing the basically the amortization of the personal loan, so in terms of, from a monetary point of view, the personal loan feels like it's costing us more because it's potentially going to be a higher value.
Mm.
But ultimately, you still need to focus, in my view, on paying off the highest expense debt first. Some other people would advocate that you pay off the smallest amount because that feels like you're accomplishing things. But the numbers tell us that if you can pay off the money that's costing you the most first, then you can start hitting the personal loan quicker and pay that off. And so overall, if you let that personal loan run its full course, it may cost you more. But if you were really diligent in saving and paying off the cost of the higher interest amount, you'll be better off in the long term.
Yeah, I agree, Ben. Mathematically, it makes sense to pay off your highest debt. There is a guy in America, Dave Ramsey, who talks about the debt snowball and arranging your debts in order of the smallest to the largest, irrespective of cost.
Yep. And so does the barefoot investor.
It's the psychology of having a few wins.
Ooh.
So I reckon the answer, and I'm 90% in the camp of pay off your most expensive debt first. But if you've got someone who's been long-term debt, someone who is struggling, I would do the debt snowball because then they can feel within their spirit that they're having some quick wins.
Yep.
So I've got seven debts, I've now knocked it down to six, and so they feel like they're making progress because I think the biggest enemy of that person is if they do it in terms of the highest debt first, they'll get discouraged and then go and rack up more debt to make themselves feel better in the short term.
It's habitual.
Yeah.
They won't be able to change their habits. So Scott Pape does that too in terms of it makes sense from a psychology point of view, but the reality is you pay
mathematically, it makes sense to pay the most first.
Correct.
But so for 90% of the people, you do that. If you're a long-term person struggling with debt,
start having some accomplishment.
Yep.
Beautiful. Cool. All right, next one here from Laura. Hello. I have a question which you may like to answer on your podcast. When monitoring an existing IP, investment properties, capital growth, and trying to do this in an objective, non-biased, and reliable method, can you please compare and contrast just relying on a real estate agent's sales appraisal versus a proper bank valuation? Thanks in advance for this, for your time and expertise. Love the podcast and have recommended it to numerous people.
Oh,
cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
Awesome. There's a few moving parts in that. I spoke to a real estate agent this week in a suburb that we're looking to go to find a property this week. And I've done some deals with him, built up a professional relationship. And I just said, Smith Street in Smith suburb, what do you think? And he goes, oh, I know it. It's on 691 square meters. It's with one of the competitors.
Yep.
Intimately knew it and goes and gave me an indication of price within sort of, he gave me a $30,000 price gap, but he reckoned he gave me a number. So when you've got the local real estate agent who knows their patch, they know the streets. They, if I say 22 Smith Street, they can visualise what it looks like, and they are subject matter experts in, call it, four, five, six suburbs. And so if they're on the top of their game, if you get an appraisal from a real estate agent who's not trying to buy the business, they're usually bang on. Because they are so on the spot.
Yep, they're in the market daily. Yep.
Which, the reason I say it's got moving parts is because you've, from that perspective, he's got no agenda to buy the listing. Yep. Whereas if the vendor is,
if it's a listing that I'm chasing.
He may have a different dialogue.
Yeah.
Versus the valuer, who quite often has a much larger patch, who then has to go and do the same thing. Now, we've probably got some valuers listening to this and going, I'll back off Bryce. But the point is that the valuers are doing a terrific job, but they go out and do some comparable analysis on properties and to determine their market. And they throw in some environmental risks and economic risks and all those sorts of things. And they've also ultimately responsible to the bank. So for me, it depends on what they actually need the valuation for. Because if they're just a portfolio builder and they actually want an idea, well, the local real estate agent would work if it's, you know, a bit more formal and for bank lending. But there's pros and cons for both. Mm. No ultimate sort of cons to a valuer or whatever. Mm. But ultimately, just the person who's on the spot does have that intimate local knowledge of knowing exactly what it's going to be, whereas a valuer might just have to come in a bit more blind.
I agree. I mean, if I wasn't interested in selling my property and I was just looking to get a fair appraisal, I would front foot that with a couple of agents and say, hey, it's Ben here. I've got this property in Flemington. Can you give me an indication of what the sort of market's doing in this area? Now, they're going to give me a ballpark, but they're not going to try and, if they know that there's not a listing in behind it, you probably think they're going to be a little bit more realistic in terms of what they've seen and evidence of sales in that area. Coming back to the valuer, if you were to engage a valuer where you paid the professional fee, the reality for that valuer is there is a different bias. And I want to explain this. Bryce mentioned it a minute ago. But if I'm paying $300 or $400 for a valuation on a property or more, depending on the value of the property, I'm getting an independent appraisal, which in a way, the valuer is not technically fully liable for as much as they are when it comes to getting a bank valuation. The bank asks the valuer to value the property subject to a distress sale or a quick sale, right? So their job is to assess the market. Now, naturally, they're also on the hook for that. So let's say the valuer says the property's worth $600,000 and then it sells for $550,000 3 months later and the bank don't get their money returned to them, the valuer is on the hook for the difference. Okay, that they'll be called in on their professional indemnity. So the reality is that even if the valuer is trying to do the best professional job they are, there is absolutely, you know, it's for bank valuation purposes and they put that down based on the conditions that the bank is asking for that valuation. If I'm getting a valuation based on market, at the market at that time, it might be a relationship separation or whatever, effectively the valuer is sort of saying, well, I can be a bit more bullish, you know, and subtly bullish on the valuation of that. So you can potentially get two different valuations from a valuer as well. So that's why I would do the appraisal with, you know, the local market expert, and I would sit on that as a good indication for now. I wouldn't necessarily pay for a valuer unless I had some need for, you know, a contract or a separation or whatever.
Mm. As you know, Ben, when we travel around the country talking to audiences, I ask the question, who's the most important? If you're a buy and hold property investor versus a buy and sell, if you're a buy and hold, who is the most important person in the entire equation? Like the tenant, you know, the tax man, the property manager, the accountant. But ultimately, in my view, the most important person is the valuer.
Mm.
Because if I'm a buy and hold, ultimately I'm playing the finance game, I'm playing the harvest equity game, and the valuer is the person that stands in between me and getting my outcomes. So ultimately, if you think about the valuer being the most important person in the entire equation, and then reverse engineer that every time you make a decision on what to buy, remember, a person who's a valuer is going to walk into your property, hopefully, and they're going to assess that with comparable sales around the area. They're going to make a determination and, as you said, send it off to the bank, which will determine how much money you can actually get. So make no mistake, they are, without doubt in my view, the most critical person for someone who's building a portfolio for a buy and hold strategy.
100%. And if we are talking about some markets that are coming to the top of their cycle, this is probably a time you need to go back to your mortgage broker or your banker and potentially look to get a valuation on the property at the top of the cycle so you can lock in that value and potentially release some of that equity for future opportunities. Because as Bryce was saying, you know, the tide is swinging in the buyer's interests. So over the course of the next couple of years, there could be some phenomenal opportunities. You want to be poised to be able to take action on those opportunities.
And as Dean said in our training yesterday, Ben, he said the question to ask an investor is, do they have a borrowing capacity or do they have a lending strategy? And the difference is enormous. Because the people come into our buyer's agency team, I've got the finance covered. Well, okay, let's unpack that a little bit. Do you have a borrowing capacity or do you actually have a strategy that's looking at the big picture when it comes to lending? And
so Dean's one of our mortgage brokers, just for everyone's benefit.
So very, very subtle point that Dean made, but very crucial point.
Very, very important point. So thank you, Laura. That's a great question.
All right, I've got one here from Glenn. Hi, guys. Love your show. I've listened to every episode and eagerly await the new podcast episode each week, including the 73 new ones this week. My wife and I bought a house in Croydon, Victoria, 2.5 years ago, which has since appreciated by nearly 20%. We are looking at buying our first investment property this year around mid-year. We had a child last year. My wife will be going back to work part-time mid-year and is currently on maternity and LSL leave. What's LSL leave? Anyway, my salary will be about $100,000 more than her. Long service leave.
Thank you.
Did you hear the stig almost then? That was actually the stig. Long service. My salary will be about $100,000 more than hers. My question is, will it make sense to get the investment loan out in my name so that the losses can be claimed against my greater income? Oh, this is a great fundamental question. For some reason, she is apprehensive about this idea, which I'm not sure why, because we are married and the titles can still be put in both of our names, even though the finance is in my name. Is this worth considering this, or should everything just be in both our names, joint loans and the like? Thanks for your time. With a disclaimer here, Ben, that it's got talk to your accountant about the guidance we're about to give.
So the reality here is if your intention, if your dominant purpose is to get a better tax deduction, then you can't necessarily go out and do that. You need to have a reason as to why you would put it into your name. Now, in terms of Glenn's case here, the argument could be that your wife's a little bit apprehensive. You're not so apprehensive, so you potentially want to go off and buy this investment property. So you buying that investment property against your income could be beneficial. But remembering it's for that reason alone, it's not necessarily for the tax deductions or the negative gearing benefits. So it's important for you to understand that. Sit down with your accountant and look at that. I mean, we do have couples come into our business and they say, oh, we want to put it into both people's names because we want to basically have joint ownership, or, you know, we're in a relationship but we want to have an interest in it. The reality is that if you're in a de facto or a spousal relationship, you already have an interest in it. I mean, the family court would recognise any interest at all. So what we do potentially see a lot of when clients come to us after they've spoken to their accountant is that they will look to buy the property in the higher income earner's name. And when they buy it in the higher income earner's name, that is beneficial for them at that time. And they've discussed why they're doing that with their accountant. And that's, you know, part and parcel. It's just really important to understand that when you're looking at these things, you need to understand the pros and cons. Because the flip side of this is when the properties become positively geared, because most properties will become positively geared, is that you're going to, you know, and if you've got really high income, well, that's going to add to the tax you're paying. So it's all about timing that and sitting down and doing some of those models.
I think an important footnote there too, Ben, is it's not about where the loan, it's what's the name that are on the title. So if you know, he talks about having 50-50 here and more loan in his name, it's irrespective. The tax department will go for what's on the contract.
Correct. So if the title's 50-50,
doesn't matter
about the loan. Both people have to be on the loan.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got tenants in common and joint tenants. Mm. So it's really, you need to understand that. So the percentages that you're owning can be documented on the contract, and that would be relative to the interest that you would be able to claim. And in some cases, you can both be on the loan, but if the property is owned by one person at 100%, they will get 100% of the cost deductions associated with that property.
So it's what's on the title versus what's on the loan. So very good question, Glenn. Thank you for that.
That's great.
That's good. All right, we want to get to, you've actually got an expanded, did you know? So I think we should get to
It's a census time. We've got to make sense of it. So
all right.
I definitely wanted to start with, I've got my little bit of paper here. I'm highly organised, Bryce, highly organised. So I'm just going to sort of stumble my way through this. But what have we got first?
I was actually going to say you're highly organised because we've got the life hack. But my life hack today, Ben, is... and I'm actually getting some really good feedback about these life hacks.
Oh, good.
Despite your overtones.
Do I have overtones?
Yeah.
Iverson and I have a bit of a giggle every now and then, but that's all right.
I still haven't recovered from my post-it note one. I was struggling that day, I've got to say.
It was a good one. Hey, I used it a couple of times.
Do you know how we went to ARIC and we saw Chris Voss, the FBI hostage negotiator? Mm-hmm. I've been really addicted to his stuff, right?
Okay.
So I've been on YouTube watching his videos and all that sort of stuff.
Is it the way he talks?
Well, he's got a pretty effective way, hasn't he?
I'll call you every hour on the hour. I'll let you know that your son's going to be safe.
Mate, you could get a job as John Wayne, sort of.
That's what he was like. His voice was.
He was. But he's. He said that when you're negotiating, he said, don't try and get the person to say yes. Because if people feel a bit unsafe if you're trying to wield them into saying yes. So I'm thinking of this if we're negotiating with partners, we're negotiating with bosses, except for the Empower Wealth group who are listening to this, don't listen to these two. But, in terms of what we're trying to do is get them to say, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's power. So the analogy that he used, and I really loved it, Ben, was when he talked about where he was called in to a hostage situation for a couple that had their child kidnapped in Haiti. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And he's talking to the frantic parents on the phone, and he's saying to them, look, I've got this covered because what I know is the Haitian kidnappers like to party on a Saturday night.
Mm.
So I actually know that today's Thursday, I should have this wrapped up for you by the latest on Saturday morning, but maybe on Friday, because he knows that and the parents don't. Because the Haitian don't want to go through, these guys don't want to be through the kidnapping negotiations on the Saturday night when they're going to a party.
Mm.
So some of these kidnappers were...
It's crazy, isn't it? But that's the way the world operates.
Mm. So the idea was to get them to say, right. So he talked about this guy, and I think it was the Philippines, who was just an awful man. Like, think Saddam Hussein, but even worse. Yep. Doing all these terrible things to people. And so ultimately what they trained that negotiator to do was to get this person to ultimately said, you know, you're frustrated with the American government. Mm. You've been become a minority.
You're ostracized. It's, you know, your people aren't being looked after.
Effectively just went on this, you know, empathetic scenario where this hostage person, the person who was taking hostage, ended up just going, that's right.
That's right. You understand me.
No, he didn't even say that. Just goes, that's right. And then within, I think it was a couple of hours, all of the hostages were released, and it was a successful one. Apparently he rings the office about a week later, and he wanted to speak to the lead negotiator, and he said, have you been promoted yet? And the guy goes, what do you mean? He goes, I don't know what you said to me. I don't know what you did, and I let everyone go, but whatever it did, it worked, so they should promote you. And he hung up. And ultimately what he did is he got the person to say, that's right. Feel understood.
We said he was going to kill him. He says, I was going to kill him.
I was going to kill everyone, and I didn't do that. So there you go, folks. There's a technique for you. If you're negotiating with your spouse, you're negotiating with your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your boss, you don't want to get him to say yes. You don't want to get him to say no. You want him to get him to say, that's right.
You need to get on the same page. You're trying to get a win-win outcome where you can, and I think that's imperative. So that's some gold.
So
there.
YouTube, that folks, YouTube, Chris Voss. I've been pouring over. It's terrific stuff because obviously we negotiate every day, so it's sharpened up.
Best negotiations.
Yep.
Bryce,
did you know?
It's census was released. So the broader census was released. We got a good snapshot across Australia of our
Australia.
Of our population and basically our household compositions, etc., our age composition, the whole lot. So here we go. First of all, did you know our population as at? Now, remember, this is data back to August of last year, so it's still 2016 data, but it's the best snapshot. We get it every 5 years, for those of you who don't know. We did one in 2011, and obviously this is the latest one. So first of all, what's our population, Bryce?
Do you want me to say? I know the
answer. Yeah, go.
24.4 million.
23.4 million.
That's what
just,
I was doing.
Just an extra million. There we go. Okay. Our population grew by 1.9 million or 1,037 people every day since the last census.
Wow.
So we're growing. We're growing.
We've got some busy adults, haven't we? Nine months ago.
I wanted to. No, they all didn't come in the one day, mate. That would be a difficult thing for our...
I said 9 months ago.
Yeah, true. All right, so I want to focus. There's plenty of good stuff in there, and we'll put a little video up that sort of summarises a few things.
On social media?
Yeah, on social media. I've got a few things that I wanted to share with you. So I really wanted to look at the dwelling structure because that's of interest to me. So this is what we've been banging on about in terms of practicality tests and a biased decision quadrants and so forth. So separate houses in 2011 represented 75.6% of the market.
Ooh.
Right? Now in 2016, the new census, it represents 72.9. So it's actually decreased as a percentage. Mm-hmm. So obviously less and less people living in separate houses.
Mm.
Right. Now, in addition to that, this is where the transition's happening. Semi-detached row terraces, townhouses has increased from 9.9% of the market stock to 12.7% of the market stock.
Boom.
So it's gone from 765,900 odd to 1,055,000. So that's been a big increase. So that is, so we put that into context, and this is us, you know, sort of reading into the data. Obviously separate houses are becoming more expensive. Mm. So the next best composition could be a townhouse where I still get the number of bedrooms that I need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what we're seeing a transition to. So are they then sacrificing on location? Not so much, you know, so our budget, our location is still very important to us. And if we can accommodate a smaller type dwelling in the right area, that's what we're moving towards.
We'll go to the buyer's decision quadrant. We go price, correct, location, size of land. So they're going from a big quarter acre block surrounded by, you know, detached house surrounded by, you know, a garden with a hill's voice and a barbecue. Now it's...
Correct. So they're compromising down to that smaller size of land, but they don't want to compromise on its location.
Mm.
Now, I mean, obviously this is our interpretation, because if we then have a look at...
Well, it's practicality.
You'd think so. Flats and apartments was 13.6% in 2011. It's now gone to 13.1%. So the reality is there is, if you're thinking about that, it's like we still, other than Sydney, we absolutely know, because we've talked about this before, in Sydney, we started building more apartments in Sydney in 1991, and we only started building more apartments in areas of Melbourne and Brisbane from around 2012 to 2013. So we've got 20 years to, you know, adapt to this lifestyle belief of living in apartments. So that's going to come. Mm. But first of all, we're resisting that by still going to townhouses and that type of thing before we will reside in these types of apartments until they become so expensive, then the apartments will start to justify living in a two-bedroom apartment. So that was really interesting for me. Other dwellings, pretty much flat at 64,000. I don't even know what those other dwellings are. All right.
Tents.
Number of bedrooms. So let's dig a little bit deeper into the number of bedrooms. So what we've seen here is definitely some changes in regards to bedroom composition. And the biggest one has been in three bedrooms to four bedrooms. So we're seeing here that in 2011, we had 43.6% of our stock, which was 3.379 million, okay, was the composition of three bedrooms. And now that's gone. So three bedrooms has only increased slightly to 3.4 million, but it's dropped from 43.6 down to 41.1 in terms of the composition of stock. Now, interestingly enough, four bedroom houses have gone up reasonably significant. So it was 30% of the stock. It's now 32% of the stock in the marketplace. Whereas one bedrooms has gone from 4.7 to 5%. Two bedrooms has dropped from 19.1 to 18.9. So quite a subtle difference there. So the biggest transition we are definitely seeing is, and if you think about it, when we buying those houses, we're basically buying those houses based on, you know, if we want a family and our composition of a household, remember, is now two kids. So it's almost two children per couple. So from that point of view, when we do buy, we want the spare bedroom. Mm. We want to have that extra bedroom. So that's continuing, other than obviously, you know, as we transition to these semis and so forth. So we talk about practicality reasons. That's why four-bedroom apartments closer to the city are doing so well, because most people want them. And if you've got that double household income, because if you don't have that double household income, you are completely shot in terms of being able to buy into those locations. So that's the dwelling composition. The other thing I wanted to just quickly mention was in regards to weekly incomes. So we've seen here, there's a couple of good news stories in here as well. So with our household weekly income, less than 650 gross weekly income. So back in 2011, 23.7% of our gross weekly income was less than $650. That's gone down to 20%. So in other words, more people are earning more, and that's also then reflected in the fact that more, so 3,000 gross weekly income is now 16.4% of the population, when it, back in 2011, was 11.2. Now, why is that important? I keep banging on about, is there systemic risk in the property market? Well, I think this is where we're going to solve that problem. So when we start to think and combine that with medium mortgage repayments across Australia, now obviously it's still harder in Sydney, but this is where it becomes really, really interesting. So the median mortgage repayment on a monthly basis in 2011 was $1,800. But the median mortgage repayment in 2016 is $1,755. So it's actually come down. You know, so it's really good to see that we're basically got, you know, households where mortgage repayments are less than 30% of the household income is 92.8. So that basically means that 92.8% of households have mortgage repayments of less than 30% of their household income. That is a really solid sign to say that we can. Now, that's up from 90.1% in 2011.
Mate, the Americans won't want to, you know, the Americans who fly in and say that our market's going to burst. They won't want to read that stat.
That's right. So this is, I suppose, underpins the confidence I have in regards to the broader market. Now, obviously, if interest rates were to go up significantly and we had a recession or something like that, that's going to be greatly impacted. And also, don't forget, this was 2016 data. We've had probably another 15% growth in some markets on top of this. So it's definitely getting to the top of the cycle in some of those markets. But it just gives me some real confidence to know that our weekly household income, I think, has grown across Australia by $100. A week from what it was in 2011. So we have had wage growth. We've been arguing that it's been a bit sluggish the last couple of years, but we have had that wage growth. And broadly across Australia, there are still some obviously very affordable areas to live, so long as you can get a job. There you go.
So obviously you've been here with us for 5 years, so lunch is on you. You got an extra $100 in your pocket. Seriously, hey? He can't talk, so he won't be able to respond.
So there's lots more data in there. We'll get down into the nitty-gritty. And obviously, you know, from a macro level, we don't believe in the broader macro data. To buy properties, you need to get asset selection right. And as we heard from that great email, that long one that you read out from those couple earlier, from our friend Joel. Joel and...
I might hang you in it. Not help you out here.
I can't remember everyone's name.
Do you remember when you hung me in it about 6 or 7 ago?
Joe and Sian. There we go. Thank you, Joe and Sian. Sorry about that. So the reality is yeah, you know, that's basically what's... I can't even remember what I was talking about.
Mate. Because asset selection is really important.
That's right.
As per the long email that took you 4 minutes to find out who it was from.
Yeah. So what I'm saying there is that these sales folk can show really fancy projections and do really great things, but at the end of the day, you know, 80% of what they told you was factually right, and then the other 20% is where they let you down in terms of where they're buying the assets. So the micro is where the real detail's at, and, you know, drum roll, Location Score. I'm just excited. So if you haven't registered for Location Score, I'm highly organised. I'm on fire. Yep. If you haven't registered for Location Score, do that, because it's imminent.
It's imminent. Locationscore.com.au.
I'm talking days.
Well, mate, you're going.
I mean, there's 365 days in a year, so
mate, you're announcing to that it's going days.
It's days.
Okay, there you go, folks. So
everyone's just cracked the wallies in my office because there's still a lot of data programming work to be done. But hey, that's what we know. It's all about the hustle.
What does it say?
Hustle
beats talent when talent won't hustle. There you go.
There we go.
So
is that one of your?
No, it was Tom's.
Yeah, of course it was. Thanks, Tom.
It's Tom. Okay, so upcoming, you preempted it. I've just pulled over a piece of paper and wrote it. So we've got Jeremy on next week.
Yes.
So he has spent an enormous amount of time in research. So
he is. So he's obviously our co-partner in Location Score. So we're really excited about bringing him into the team.
Ben, we're going to talk about the key metrics that you need to understand if you want to understand the forces of supply and demand.
Can't wait.
You don't want to miss next week.
No, next week is going to be...
We don't want the server down next week.
No.
We don't want the server down next week. We want everyone to hear that.
Yeah,
so
very excited.
So go to locationscore.com.au, Ben. As you said, register. There's an opportunity for you to let us know. We've asked you a couple of questions there. We actually read them all.
Yep.
And of course, a few things, social media, at The Property Couch, at Bryce Holdaway, at Ben Kingsley.
Don't forget the book.
Go for it.
The Armchair Guide to Property Investing. If you haven't checked it out, we've got copies, discounts for our listeners.
This is our only sort of flagrant sort of promotion.
Here comes an ad from our sponsor.
What about the book? Does everyone want to buy the book? So, very good. All right. Well, what a terrific episode. Oh, you happy with that? Got a little clap. Beautiful. So, Ben, this is where I put you on the spot.
Mm.
Until next week.
Knowledge is empowering, but only if you
follow through.
So, yeah. Act on it.
Yeah, act on it. So there you go, folks. Act on the knowledge and you will have a very effective follow through. Until next week, mate. We'll see you later.
See you later.